In the beginning of the, when I went to New Mexico with Tyler and James, James being Gary Nolan,
yeah.
James and I were constantly thinking, you know, is this information that this person is planting so that we can, you know, be the means through which it's disseminated? All right. So like, you know, a plant. And I keep this question open throughout American Cosmic. And also, it becomes part of my methodology because there's inherent deception here that that I'm looking at. And I'm looking at the theoretical framework of American Cosmic is that, and this is an academic book, by the way, mostly for the academic audience. So what I'm doing is I'm basically shifting methods because we usually use the historical critical method to study religions. And what I'm doing is I'm going in and I'm saying the UFO is an example of a new form of religion.
Disclaimer: the views expressed by our podcast guest are their own and do not necessarily reflect the opinions or endorsements of our sponsors and advertisers. Similarly, our sponsors and advertisers do not necessarily endorse or support the views expressed by our podcast guest.
We are Area 51 Coffee Company. Coffee for regular humans and coffee with twice the caffeine of a typical cup with a buzz that's out of this world. Coffee connoisseurs from across the galaxy seek out our smooth brew with a hint of sweetness in a perfect roast. Area51CoffeeCo.com. You will also be assimilated with our Area 51 merchandise. We are invading Earth one cup at a time. We are Area 51 Coffee Company. Area51CoffeeCo.com.
I am here to discuss the so-called flying saucers.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's.
Did the CIA write Wind of Change by the Scorpions?
As humans busied themselves about the various concerns, they were scrutinized and studied.
Dr. Loeb, what percentage chance do you give it that you have indeed uncovered extraterrestrial or non-human technology?
With infinite complacence, people went about their affairs, yet across an immense ethereal gulf, intellects vast and unsympathetic drew their plans against us.
Prior to your abduction, did you believe in UFOs or any sort of alien life form?
All things unexplained.
So some of that, I think, sir, we'll save for closed session.
Hey, Unexplained Ones, we are so excited to have Diana Pasulka on our show today. She is an academic scholar and professor known for her work in religious studies, particularly focusing on the intersection of religion, technology, and culture. She is most known recently for her two books, American Cosmic and Encounters, and their claims that she has been to a UFO recovery site. We are excited to talk to her about UFOs, technology, and the impact of digital culture on religion and spirituality.
Make sure to click the links in the description to pick up your copy of Encounters and American Cosmic. And while you're at it, if you want to help us out on our road to disclosure, make sure to subscribe, comment, like, and share. It really helps us defeat the evil algorithms. Thanks so much.
Hey, Unexplained Ones. You know what keeps me going each day? Coffee. Lots and lots of coffee. If you want the best coffee this side of the Milky Way, then you need to go check out Area 51 Coffee Co. They offer their extraterrestrial bean coffee for us regular humans and their DEFCON 1 coffee that has twice the caffeine for those who are ready to take their taste buds on a journey to the unknown. Head to Area51CoffeeCo.com to grab yourself a bag and check out their extraordinary merchandise. That's Area51CoffeeCo.com, invading Earth one cup at a time. Hello, Diana. Welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show, CJ and Dr. Mounts.
Thank you for coming. We're going to dive right in because we have had the opportunity to read both American Cosmic and Encounters over the past few weeks, and the questions are never ending for us. We've had all kinds of conversations, and we just want to pick your brain. So here we go. So Diana, you have spent over a decade now, really, intersecting your professional career as a professor of religious studies with the study of the UFO phenomenon. That journey has taken you into the world of technology, AI, quantum theories. You've had access to UFO crash retrieval sites, as well as the Vatican archives. In your book, Encounters, you quote someone describing interactions with the phenomenon as an awakening of a human being to the cosmos in which they live. When was your awakening, and what was the catalyst for it?
I think it's a process. So I think there's still an awakening happening. And I guess that I've been, you mean the awakening to this topic?
Yeah.
This definitely happened in 2012. So it was late 2012. And I just finished a book about I surveyed purgatory, the idea of purgatory in the Catholic history tradition. And I'd seen a lot of anecdotes about and reports from Catholic history about aerial phenomena and journeys to other worlds. And I noticed the comparison with modern day UFO reports. So I began to study modern day UFO reports as a new form of this narrative that's been historical. So it was a very academic comparative study that I began. And I wasn't a believer at all in UFOs. And so what happened was I was doing this comparative analysis, and I came across people who were involved in the study of UFOs, like Gary Nolan, and obviously Jacques Vallée, and people like that. And also people who were engaged in studying UFOs from the perspective of our government. So the, you know, people involved in these government programs studying UFOs. And that was actually pretty shocking to me. So that was my first, you know, kind of awakening that, oh, well, you know, this is definitely different than the religions that I've studied before. Because when I was studying Catholic history, although there are some mysterious things within that religion, I never met people in the government who were, you know, studying it too. So that was my first kind of awakening that this is going to be a different kettle of fish, I guess you could say.
Yes. So take us from the journey then of you've now taken on this topic of study, and next thing you know, you're getting pulled in by people like Tyler, right, who have taken you to this potential UFO crash site in New Mexico. Why you, and how did that come about? I know you do detail it a little bit in American Cosmic, but tell us about how that
happened. I don't actually have an answer to that question other than what Tyler said, because he actually wanted to meet me, and he was interested in what I was doing in my field of research. And Tyler is a person who has, you know, worked for the space program his whole life and was interested as a hobby in the topic of UFOs. And he said that a mentor had told him that my field, which was looking at consciousness and mysticism, would have answers to his field. So that's how I met him. And it took about a year and a half before I actually met him in person, because mm-hmm. at that point I was still reticent to meet people associated with these, you know, programs, because I really didn't know what was going on. I mean, this is way before 2017 and the, you know, those basically disclosures of what was happening. And I hadn't ever thought of crash retrieval programs or anything like that. So I was basically just doing my job as a professor, looking at things. So why me? I don't know.
Okay. I love it. It feels so much to me like Robert Langdon, the character from Dan Brown's books. I don't know if people have brought that up to you before.
Yes, the parallels are
really strong. It just all came to me last night. I'm like, oh my goodness, here's this professor who's getting pulled into sort of this dark culture that is invisible in some ways to help solve these mysteries. And you've been to the Vatican, and he's been to the Vatican. Anyways, okay. I have a question for you, but I'm going to ask you to bear with me because it's long-winded to get there. But there is a question at the end of all of this. So as a professor of religious studies, it wouldn't be a huge leap to say that you have a thorough understanding of the development of religions, how they come to be, and how they maintain a population of devout believers, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So in your books, American Cosmic and Encounters, you detail how media can influence our perceptions of reality. Additionally, you speak to ways in which seemingly invisible powers control that media in terms of what information we receive and how we receive it. You quote your student and later friend, Jose, speaking to how phones are a direct connection to the battlefield and social engineering intrusions interrupt the flow of social media. And then additionally, you have Simone, who discusses how AI can assist the next iteration of species of Homo sapiens, of which Homo sapiens is a part. So essentially, we are creating a new life form for which we're all currently worshiping, right? We're constantly connected to our phones and computers and such. Have you ever considered that the people behind this UFO phenomenon and whatever technology it entails have manipulated you to help them create a new religion?
Of course. In the beginning of the, when I went to New Mexico with Tyler and James, James being Gary Nolan,
yeah.
James and I were constantly thinking, you know, is this information that this person is planting so that we can, you know, be the means through which it's disseminated? All right. So like, you know, a plant. And I keep this question open throughout American Cosmic. And also, it becomes part of my methodology because there's inherent deception here that that I'm looking at. And I'm looking at the theoretical framework of American Cosmic is that, and this is an academic book, by the way, mostly for the academic audience. So what I'm doing is I'm basically shifting methods because we usually use the historical critical method to study religions. And what I'm doing is I'm going in and I'm saying the UFO is an example of a new form of religion, not just a new religion, because we already have new UFO religions. We have, you know, Nation of Islam is really intricately involved with the mothership. We have realism, right? So we've got these UFO religions. But what I'm looking at now is the digital infrastructure, right? So everyone is on their phone. So we're constantly looking at a screen. We're on a screen now. Yes. And so I'm beginning to see that this UFO belief system is now being, you know, it's being projected to all of us through the digital infrastructure and also through social media and things like that. So I'm making the case that this is a new form of religion, a new religiosity is basically what I'm saying. And it's going to be global. Okay. It's not just going to be a discrete denomination here or a type of religion here with a founder. It's going to be completely different. So I'm also including information from the history of religions, which is that, you know, some event happens that's miraculous and people, you know, say it's Buddhism or say it's Christianity. And you have, you know, this man named Jesus, who's purely, he's not writing anything down. It doesn't appear as if he's, you know, wanting to create some type of, you know, he's trying to help the Jewish people is what he's trying to do. And then you have Siddhartha Gautama, you know, the Buddha, and he's not writing anything down either. But what you do is you have a tradition that comes out of the works and you know, oral traditions of both of these people. And then you have institutionalization of that. So you see this, you know, it happens for, you know, for Christianity, it took about 100, 200 years, 300 years, 400 years for it to actually institutionalize into a state-sponsored religion. Buddhism took around the same time period. So what I'm doing here is I'm saying, okay, we should be seeing this now, right? And so I wrote that in American Cosmic. We should be seeing, you know, the institutionalization happening at some point. Maybe, I don't know, it took 400, 500 years before. Now, because of the infrastructure, it's almost instantaneous. So as soon as American Cosmic was in press when the institutionalization began to happen, which was the New York Times, you know, coming out with the with that. Okay, so this all happens, and this follows along the basically the trajectory of what I had suggested. I said, we are going to see this, but it happened a lot faster than I thought. Okay, so that shocked me. And of course, my, you know, it doesn't matter what I say now, because American Cosmic is out there as a way in which it can unfold and be utilized as a support for an agenda of, yes, this is, you know, this is real, right? So, I mean, I've said before that it doesn't have to be an either or situation. You know, maybe there's an agenda and maybe there's this, you know, push for people to believe in this topic. Yes, okay, that's true. But that doesn't take away the fact that this topic is historical and it's been around for many, many, many years, like thousands of years. And so that's why I wrote Encounters. I wanted to say, wait a minute, this has been around, right, historically. And it could be that American Cosmic is now, you know, being utilized to support current belief in UFOs. But that's not what the intention of that book was. But it actually doesn't matter, does it? And so then Encounters is basically kind of a follow-up that says, wait a minute, who's not being heard right now? You know, so there's a current, you know, emphasis on, you know, the topic. We all know that. People are actually sick of it by now. So it seems like there's so much out there. So, but who's been talking about or who knows about it that we haven't actually listened to? So I was basically sharing that information. And, you know, we tend to, and it is the case that what we see in media impacts our memories and impacts the way in which we frame what we see and what we know. So if we see something in the sky and it, you know, we don't know what it is, we assume, what we do is we think of either Independence Day or arrival or something like that, because these are the ways in which we frame an understanding of UFOs today is through media. And yeah. So media is going to be an important factor in looking at these.
Yes. And for those of you that have not picked up your copy yet of American Cosmic or Encounters, we will have a link to those in the comments. And I will tell you, I have read both. I have spent weeks now processing all of the information that I've received. I feel like I've been attempting to download more information after reading about various people's strategies for downloading information in your books. It's really fantastic. Go pick up a copy for yourself. But all of that conversation about religion and UFOs and media, I think that takes us to some of Tim's questions. So Tim, I'm going to throw it your way.
Thanks. I have to point out, we're speaking to Diana Pasulka, the amazing author of Encounters in American Cosmic. And just a bonus, by the way, CJ and I both listened to these books on Audible, and Diana Pasulka herself narrates Encounters. So that's a special treat if you get Encounters on Audible. So Diana, one thing I wanted to ask you is that, you know, there appears to be something special about humans. This might be something special about us on Earth. It could also be something special about us in this universe, or this multiverse, or this dimension, and that is this notion of a soul. What can you tell us about the soul?
Okay, so I don't really, I would have to say that a question about the soul isn't something that I don't actually talk about, because I have personal opinions about it, of course. But I mean, I'm in religious studies, so you know this, that we don't actually talk about, well, we can talk about that, but historically.
One thing I wonder, because I'm a little bit like Tyler, I believe Tyler, you said grew up Baptist, right?
Yes, yeah. We can talk about that if you want.
well, so I grew up Southern Baptist, and one thing I'm not familiar with is the Catholic notion of purgatory. As far as the academics say, what can you tell us about purgatory?
Okay, so, right. So purgatory is a Catholic idea. It's also in Eastern Orthodox and also in the Russian Orthodox Church. And so those churches predate Protestantism and all denominations of Protestantism, of course. And so this was a belief, an early belief, that when people died, their souls weren't purified enough to get into heaven. So there was a space, whether or not this was a physical space or some kind of afterlife space, this was not clear. Okay. But it was clear in the 1200s, by the way. But this was a practice that people did, Christians did all throughout Europe, in England, even here in the United States in the 1700s and 1800s and early 20th century. So this was a practice that people believed that if they prayed to God for their deceased friends and relatives, that they could help those people achieve heaven. And so that's the doctrine of purgatory. And my first book was an examination of what happened to this belief, because today, if you ask people about it, they tend not to know about it, but it's still actually a doctrine of the Eastern Orthodox and Catholic churches.
Right. And one thing you do is you bring up in one of your articles an historical reference of a nun or a sister from the 1800s that had an encounter with an orb or a ball of light. And at some point, this notion of purgatory came up, and this notion of a spear, being stabbed with a spear. What can you tell us about that?
So this was actually one of the reports that I had found. And okay, so the Ursuline nun, so she lives in France in the 1800s, and she's in a convent, and she's, you know, she has a cell where she sleeps, and at night, this ball, this sphere, right, this kind of orb thing goes into her cell, and she's afraid of it, and it stays in there for a while, and then she goes out, and she tells the mother superior of the convent, which is the person who heads up the convent, and she says, I don't know what this is, but it's, you know, frightening, and nobody actually believes her. The priest of the place doesn't believe her, the mother superior, they don't believe her, and so, but she keeps telling them that this is happening to her. So then what happens is that the mother superior finally says, okay, I'll come and I'll hang out with you at night and see what's going on. So the mother superior goes there, and sure enough, this thing comes in through a wall, and it scares both of them. So of course, this is the 1800s in France. So they're not thinking anything about UFOs. And they basically think, okay, this is a soul from purgatory. So they get the whole convent to pray for it to, you know, asking God for this thing to go away. And that's where it ends. So what I was doing with that was I actually have written an article that compares this to modern day reports of these kinds of phenomena. That's what that was about. So there were so many of those reports, but that was the only one that I put into that book on purgatory, because it wasn't a book about aerial phenomena. It was a book about purgatory, but you can tell that, you know, there was aerial phenomena, and people definitely during that time period, how were they going to, you know, interpret it? So they would interpret it as a soul from purgatory, but that wasn't the only interpretation of these things, by the way. So even 2,000 years ago, even 2,400 years ago in the Western tradition, people were thinking that these could be from other planets. So people were looking at this, and the word for it was, something that came about, I think it was in ancient Greece, but it could have been later, the plurality of worlds. So this is how it was discussed. It was, you know, there must be other worlds. And by the way, this was a very, very controversial thing to talk about all throughout the history of the look at extraterrestrial phenomena in history. So the plurality of other worlds was basically how it was framed.
Right. And of course, you know, I grew up Baptist, like I said, and there was this notion of heaven and hell. And I was always taught that the Bible, it says a lot more about hell, as a matter of fact, than it does heaven. And then we get into this notion of angels and demons. And of course, we've had a lot of talk from politicians and some other people in current ufology, you know, about a connection between demons or demonology and UFOs and ufology. And, you know, what can you tell us here about, seems to be some sort of intersection between religion and angels and demons
and modern ufology?
Yeah. So this has been around for a long time as well. In fact, when Kenneth Arnold had his sighting in 1947, if you look at the newspaper articles of the time that talked about it, because it was a viral event in the press, you see that a lot of people and people who were, you know, they were ministers and so forth, thinking that this was a sign of the end times. Okay, so it was interpreted as a sign of the end times in the 1940s. And by a lot of communities, not all communities, obviously, but there was that definitely this connection. And a lot of them interpreted these as being, you know, maybe angels or demons. And that was something that was, you know, you have as many people saying, oh, these are angels coming to tell us, like the four horsemen or something like that, coming to tell us that it's happening now. Or these are demons and we need to be prepared, this kind of thing. So this narrative has been around for a long time. And it's a narrative that predates the idea that, or actually it doesn't actually predate, it arrives side by side, this idea that perhaps these are extraterrestrial. Okay, so these, you've got both frameworks working for a long time before we get to today. So these narratives, it makes sense then that in the 1800s, a nun who's Catholic and doesn't have any kind of a scientific background is going to interpret this as a soul from purgatory. Okay, so it makes sense because that's their framework. And so that framework, though, is definitely still around. And we do have that framework, by the way. When I did speak to people who studied the topic, like Jacques Vallée, he definitely has a whole library of a history of angels and a history of fallen angels within the Christian historical tradition. And so he's looking at these, not necessarily thinking, and this is where I think it's an important way to think about this, is that he's not necessarily saying, this is why I like Jacques Vallée's work, by the way, is because he doesn't actually know what this phenomena is, and he's pretty honest about it. He basically says it has a lot of characteristics that have been identified through time as, you know, things from folklore, things from religious history, and if we look at those patterns, maybe we can learn something. And so he says whatever's happening today has also been happening historically. And he was one of the only ones that I found that did rigorous historical work about that very specific framework of interpreting this. And so, yeah, so there's a definite lineage, you could call it.
Right. And one of the interesting things, like, I grew up religious, so I was at church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, you know, tent revivals, indoor revivals, all of it. I was there as a kid and a teenager. And interestingly, I thought, you know, I've got friends to this day that will say they believe in otherworldly beings, angels and demons, but they do not believe in aliens, which are basically defined as otherworldly beings. So I find that kind of a paradox, right? But this also takes us into, you know, if we just take it to the next step, if there are angels and demons, then we might deduce that there are multiple races or multiple kinds of angels and demons. Have you had any experience in the literature, you know, with that sort of notion in terms of multiple types of aliens or angels or demons?
Well, of course, within ufology, there are many people, if they're not nuts and bolts ufologists, a lot of people then say, oh, they're consciousness based. And, you know, but there are a lot of people who believe in different types of galaxies and different varieties, like the tall grays. I mean, the tall whites and the grays and, you know, things like that. So they definitely have this belief system is definitely a part of ufology and people who believe in that. You also see this in the Christian church. So in the medieval era, there's a distinct push by, well, at this point, scientists were believers, to codify the different types of angels. So there are, they say there are a variety of angels. And even a person who has a contact with an angel, say Teresa of Avila, who's a nun in the Spanish nun in the 1500s, and she has a very interesting event where she sees something that's small and she doesn't know what it is at first because it doesn't look like an angel to her. She's like, this is something that's real. I actually see it. It's not imagining, you know, I'm not imagining it. And she says that it is, she then says it must be a cherub. That must be the type of angel that it is. So, you know, she doesn't know what it is, but it's a being and it's there. She has a contact event with it. So, you know, even, you know, so it indicates that there is already an idea of many of these kinds of things, many of these kinds of beings that are called angels. And then even in 1980s, you go to the 1980s, because this is part of the work that I did in the early stages of the research for American Cosmic, was I begin to wonder, okay, what does the Christian church say about angels? What does the Christian church say about, you know, aerial phenomena and these kinds of things? And so I went back and I found a treatise that wasn't actually meant for the public, but for bishops. And it was written by John Paul II. And it was called The Treatise on Angels. And it's all, you can look at it online. It's out there online. And basically he says to his bishops, these are Catholic bishops, he says, you don't believe in angels today, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. It just means that rationalism has eradicated the widespread belief in angels, but they still exist and they still intervene in human history, just as our scriptures say. So he's basically kind of calling them on their disbelief of what is said in their own scriptures. And I thought that was really interesting. And it's a great little essay too.
That is interesting. And it really opens the door, however, to some of the more disturbing aspects that people see in the phenomenon. Such as, you know, if we are dealing with humans and a soul, and we're dealing with multiple races of aliens or, you know, biblical beings, angels, demons, and they're influencing our society or our lifespan on this planet, you know, it kind of opens the door for some sort of nefarious things. Like, is there a faction that has a malevolent interest in us? Is there a faction that has a benevolent interest in us? What do you see in the literature that can help explain this to us between, you know, biblical times and ancient or 1600s, 1800s, and now?
Yeah. Okay, so this is a really good question. And I focused on this idea in many of the encounters in that book. What I wanted to do is I wanted to show how people are interpreting these experiences, okay? And there's a scientist that I focus on who has these experiences. They're, you could call them like abduction experiences, right? And among
you're referring to the gray man?
Yes. He's a scientist who has had lifelong experiences. And then and I compare him to Kerry Mullis, who is he won the Nobel Prize in chemistry, and I've met him, and he has his own book out where he talks about his experience. He's deceased, so he's passed away. But he's a really amazing scientist. And so he also was very open about his experience, and he didn't interpret it to be a good experience. He didn't like it at all. And so the gray man looks at his experience through the lens of Christianity. And he basically says that if this was just extraterrestrials, then why would we have all of the supernatural and paranormal behavior around these events? And I thought that that was a great way to discuss these things, because it's not just him. It was so many people have the same things happen. And we're talking about people who are police officers, you know, people who are detectives, people who are pilots, you know, and I had to put that in there because I thought nobody's actually talking about this. And it's something that's a pattern. And so if it's a recurring thing, we don't just say it doesn't exist or we don't look at it. It's probably part of it. So that's why I focused on that. So he was having a lot of disturbing paranormal events. And then we have Jose, who's my former student, who also was having experiences. And he's really focused on, you know, his mission, which is to help young people, but also people and veterans, you know, help them. And so he's got, you know, he's Christian too. And so he's also looking at this, and he is a position where he doesn't actually want to focus on these because he just wants to do his mission. So when he does see something, a craft or something like that, he sees it and he doesn't ignore it. But he also, you know, I talk about his background where his family comes from an evangelical Christian background, and his father, you know, did deliverance in his house when he was having some of these experiences. So this would be his, you know, his experience as well. So we've got two people in the book who are specifically addressing this issue that you're asking about. And I think that it's an issue that, you know, definitely would never be brought up in Congress, at least, you know, today. So it, but it's part of what you find when you do this research. And I'm not the only one who's found this. Jacques Vallée has found this, Gary Nolan too. So when we were actually going to the site in New Mexico, one of the things that he said was, you know, Diane, if this was like 100 years ago, you'd be looking at these as angels and demons, you know, and that's in American Cosmic. So he's also aware of this part, and his research uncovers a lot of very disturbing things. So yeah, I would suggest that when people are looking at this and they're new to it, they need to be aware that it's a lot more complicated than just what we see in entertainment media.
Right. I think all you're going to get from Congress is this sort of thing right here.
So some of that, I think, sir, we'll save for closed session.
They're just saving it for closed session. It's not for the rest of us. So it's interesting you brought up Gary Nolan. What sort of disturbing things that you can talk about as he turned up?
Well, he talks
about that.
Himself.
I'm sorry. We're talking about, can you tell everybody who Gary Nolan is, by the way?
Yeah. So in, I met Gary Nolan probably about 2013, maybe 2014. And he was a person that Jacques introduced me to, and he's a scientist at Stanford, and he's a really top rate world class scientist. And he has a bunch of labs at Stanford. And so he's interested in this topic because he is an experiencer, and he's been very public about this, but he wasn't at first because, you know, before the disclosures came out from the New York Times and so forth, this was still pretty under the, you know, people didn't want to be known. And so I use pseudonyms, which, by the way, I have to do as a professor, because it's part of the ethical process of doing field research. So if people want to be protected with a pseudonym, it is my duty to protect them with that, even if people know who they are. So I just wanted to say that because a lot of people are asking me, you know, why don't you just say who these people are? So Gary came out probably about a year and a half ago on Twitter and said, I'm James. So in American Cosmic, he's this professor that I meet. He studies this and he's a scientist. And we go out to New Mexico because Tyler's taking us out there and he wants to show us, you know, these debris from this crash site. And I'm not a believer at that point. And so that's who James is. And so some of the disturbing research that he's engaged in is basically he wants to create, or at least he did during the writing of American Cosmic, he wanted to create some type of interface so that this thing didn't, it could happen on our terms and not on the terms of whatever it is, whatever this phenomena is. So he wanted to create like a pill or something that people could take so that this wouldn't happen to them. Because sometimes what happens to people is that, you know, well, it's not on their own terms, right? It happens to them. They have no agency in this. They're not autonomous. This happening when they're sleeping sometimes, right? And they are not enjoying it. You know, they don't like it. It's disturbing. And so he wanted to stop it from happening. And he wanted to learn everything he possibly could. And part of what he learned was that these had effects on people. And you could see this. So I'm going to use an example. So as soon as American Cosmic was published, I got a lot of mail, a lot of email.
I bet you did.
Yes. And a lot of correspondence, like hard copy mail, right? And I couldn't get through everything. So I still have a stack of these, you know, letters that are sent to me. And they're generally sent to me, you know, from people who are 70, right? Or, you know, something like that. Because they're not gonna look me up online and, you know, and email me. Some are, but not everyone. So I had a letter that I read about, oh gosh, 4 months ago. Because every once in a while I take one out and I read it. And it was really long. And it was basically a history that this person was giving me of their own experiences. And they said that they had these experiences as a young person in the 50s, and that they kept having these experiences. So they started to follow up with it and to learn about the topic. And they said that at some point in the 1970s, they were following the pilots that would have these reports. And then one of the pilots had an interaction, and then, you know, it was a bad interaction and they died. Okay. So then they said, after that, I decided to stop following the topic because it was depressing. And I read that letter and I was like, yeah, you know, that. So there is a lot of that happens too. So a lot of people think, oh, it must be a great thing to have happen, but I would not wish it upon anyone.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay. That's an interesting take. I've heard both sides of it, of course, like you said. Quick question before I want to dive into technology a little bit. But do you think that science and religion are often trying to tell the same story and just using two different languages?
It depends.
Specifically in terms of this UFO phenomenon that we're dealing with now. Or we'll take UFO out of it, the phenomenon that we're dealing with right now.
Okay. Okay, so I think that science is exploratory, right? So it's basically trying to figure out what's happening. And you can't necessarily, like in my field, as a person who studies religion, we don't actually bring our belief into it. Because if you bring your own biases and belief into the study, you're going to, the results won't be.
Yes, sway the outcome. You
know, yeah. So I see science as being that, as doing the best that it can. Now, the problem is that there's sometimes you just can't help but do that because there are unexamined assumptions that a person has. So, and I can give examples of that as well. So, do I think that they're trying to basically say the same thing, but like religion and science are trying to, I think religion is about your, religion is a lot of things. So I don't know if I can answer that question.
Let me ask more specifically. Do you think that they are both trying to define the same phenomenon using different
languages? Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay. So some religions are trying to do that. So when you have the Nation of Islam, they're talking about these ships in the sky that they see, and they call them the mothership and then the baby ships and things like that. So they're identifying aerial phenomena and they already have a framework for understanding it. So they definitely are doing that. And that's within their religion. Other religions don't, you know, are going to be calling them. So I'm not quite sure if I can answer the question.
Okay, no, that's fine. So let's dive into technology a little bit because it plays a huge role in both of your books, especially in your relationship to Tyler, who comes into your life and he has all of these patents and has developed all sorts of technology. Do you think, I shouldn't say do you think, has your research shown you that whatever this phenomenon is giving us technology that we are using to further advance our civilization?
Yeah, I don't know if I can answer that, but what I can say, I don't know that. I mean, that's $100 million question right there, because if it was, you know, true, I think that we'd have, and, you know, a lot of people like clamoring to connect with whatever it is. And what I've seen is that the history of science is not as cut and dry as we think it is. It's a history of what I call unorthodox science. So a lot of scientists, even in our space program, like Jack Parsons, or even in the Russian space program, like Konstantin Tsiolkovsky, what they're doing is they're engaged in believing that there are beings that they're getting information from, okay? Whether or not that's true, I don't know. Okay, I don't think that we can prove it one way or the other, but that they're engaged in this process, I think, is really interesting. So you see the process of people engaging in, you know, like the mathematician Srinivasan Ramanujan. Okay, so he believes that Lakshmi, the goddess that he, you know, he's Hindu, so Lakshmi is giving him these calculations.
Which of course his fellow students loved, right? He was just given the information. They loved
it. Right,
that,
yeah, sure. That would be so easy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you have several people that you discuss who have similar situations. And one thing that comes up over and over again is the human body as sort of a receptor for information, just in terms of how our body is created, in terms of the amount of water that's in our body. You talk about, I think it was Tyler who mentioned, our spinal cord is a lot like hard wiring when you open it up and take a look at it. Can you tell us a little bit about that theory, that maybe our body is actually receiving these signals and some people's bodies are better at doing so?
Well, receiving signals from the phenomena or just receiving
from the phenomena.
Signals in general? Yeah.
From the phenomena.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So this is a belief that Tyler has, and it's a belief. It doesn't mean that it's true or not true, but a lot of people do believe that if they then, you know, our bodies are more than 70% water. So yeah, and water is a conductive medium. And it appears, based on science today, that there's bioelectricity that is happening and you know, gives information to our bodies. So I would say that, that yes, I think that people are believing that that's the case. And therefore, you know, people are interested in what Tyler did in order to receive information. But to me, his belief system changed. So at first he thought that he was in touch with extraterrestrials, right? Or off planet beings, as he called them. But his beliefs changed when he went to the Vatican and he had a conversion. So they became much more aligned with this idea that these beings, when I was finished writing that, his belief system went from these are extraterrestrials, off planet beings, to these look a lot like what we find in Christian history. Maybe they're angelic beings, or, you know, because he never had negative experiences with them. And he looked like Konstantin Tchaikovsky and, you know, those people. So I put him in that tradition.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting is what you describe in terms of how he would receive those messages, right? He would make sure that his body was as pure as it could be in terms of what he ate and the yoga practices that he did. And he had this routine for how he would sit outside in the sun and download this information. Didn't sound all that different to me than people who maybe say fast and go and seek answers from God or pray or sit in silence or what have you, or even those that can find deeper states of consciousness through meditation. There seems to be something happening here that some people are able to connect to and others aren't. What it is that they're connecting to, maybe it's the same, maybe it's different. I don't know. But it was an interesting study on preparing our bodies for receiving information.
Yeah, so it is a monastic tradition. So when you look at Christianity, we don't tend to focus, at least, Catholicism is the largest denomination of Christians. And then in the United States, we have a lot Protestants, right? And Protestants, okay, so Protestant Reformation didn't happen until 1500. So, you know, the Eastern Orthodox and Catholic Church was around already for that time period. And so there were these traditions that there are nuns and monks and monastic tradition. So when I met Tyler, I recognized that he was not aware of those traditions, you know, and also that he was intuitively doing them. And so since then, I've met a lot of people who have these, you know, they have these ways of living that help them in their lives. And so I think there's a whole group of young people today, Exodus 90, I think it's called, that also do these kinds of traditions. And they're doing that in order to be better people, better Christians. And that what they're doing are monastic traditions and monastic practices. So there's a recurrence of this in the present age.
Yes. Yes. And it seems like these people are deeply connected. And when I say these people, I'm now referring to the Tylers and the Simones and the other people that you've talked about in your books. are connected to this phenomenon. And it feels like this phenomenon is connected to technology. And it feels like those who are connected to it have led the way in advancing AI or biogenetics or things like that. Do you think these scientists that you've been in contact with know something that the rest of us don't?
I mean, I'm not sure about that, because in encounters, I also focus on Jose, who's not a scientist, and I also focus on the gray man, who's definitely not creating science from this, although he is a scientist. So, I mean, the scientists are just, how many of them are there? There are three in the book. So they're just three in that book of many. And so I wouldn't say, now it could very well be, I'm not sure if they would, are they, I think that these are their skills. So if you take an artist who's a painter and you have them do these monastic protocols, and they become really good at painting, they're going to create a painting, okay? They're going to create a piece of art. So if you have somebody who's spent their whole life learning AI, like Simone has, and she knows how to code in every, you know, computer language, and she does the protocols, right? She's going to create something that's a scientific technology. So she's going to create a technology. So if you take Tyler, who spent his whole life, you know, in the space program, and give him, you know, he's doing these things, he's going to create patents that have to do with space. So I think that it depends on the skill set that the people have, you know, what they do. Is there kind of a, I know what you're asking, though. You're asking, is there some really terrible, you know, takeover at the moment of AI and technology and how it's displacing, you know, traditional religions and things like that? I think that's what you're asking.
Not so much about displacing traditional religions, just are there people out there who have information that they are withholding from us to further develop science?
Okay, so I think that's always been the case. And I'll give you an example. Okay, so there's the internet that we're using now. And all of us like the internet because it helps us in our work.
Yeah.
Let's just be super honest. Yeah. We do, you know, it helps us. All right. However, the internet began as a military program. Okay. And in fact, Jacques Vallée was part of the creation of the internet, which was called ARPANET. Okay. And this was in the, you know, the late 60s, 70s, you know, a long time ago. And if you read a lot, and most people don't, they don't care to look at the history of the internet or to think, you know, they're just born into it.
Yes.
And they think this is the way life has always been. But if you look at the history of it, you'll see that the internet is actually created as a military program. Now, most likely as a weapon of surveillance or something like that.
Right.
And it's developed way beyond what we are using it as now, because generally what happens is great tech happens in the military and it gets perfected. And if it's really, really good, we're not going to get it. The normal people, the non-military people, we're not going to get that tech, right? It's not going to be privatized and put out there. And for, you know, maybe for good reason, okay, to protect us, to, you know, protect the United States. So so we have the internet now, and you can imagine then that there are these groups of people who have this information, and no, they're not going to give it to us because, the you know, it's classified or something like that.
Yeah. All right, we want to get into some hot takes. We only have a little bit of time left. Well, so Tim, I'm going to toss it to you for hot takes.
Well, before we get to hot takes, since we do have 7 extra minutes, I will say I totally relate to what you're saying about the military and technology, right? Because one of my favorite books, which you mentioned in American Cosmic, is The Day After Roswell by former Army Colonel Corso, right? And he brings up some specific technology. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to research this. I'm going to hone in on this. If I can disprove this, you know, it either discredits the whole thing or casts doubt on it or something else, right? And he brings up specifically night vision technology, which he credits to reverse engineering alien technology discovered at Roswell or somewhere else in New Mexico. And I defy anybody out there to find the true source of night vision technology, because you're not going to. It's completely mysterious. All we know is it was born out of the Army, and that's all we know. So I totally relate to what you're saying, Diana. But the one thing CJ and I were both wondering, and by the way, we're so lucky to be speaking to Diana Pasulka, author, professor, author of Encounters in American Cosmic. You can pick both those up by clicking the links in the description of this show. And you revealed yesterday, we want to congratulate you, by the way.
Yes, this is so exciting.
We want to bring this up because you revealed on your Twitter, I believe it's at DW Pasulka, that the producers of Game of Thrones contacted you to make a television show about your books. Can you tell us anything else about that? And congratulations, by the way.
Oh, yeah, thank you. Yeah. Yeah, it was one of the producers. So I think there are, I don't know how many producers, but one of the producers reached out to me probably about 7 months ago. And we've been in conversation and finally it's...
made the deal.
Yeah, made the deal. So, yeah.
That's great. Congratulations.
I'm sure you've thought into, you know, what this show series would look like. Who would play Diana Pasulka? Who would play Tyler?
Yeah, so... we agreed that it was going to be fictionalized from the books. So it wasn't necessarily going to be based on, if it was going to be based on, you know, the historical, what happened, it's going to be very loosely based on that, we believe. So we'll see how it goes. But I don't know. I haven't thought that far in advance.
If you could pick any one person, who would it be?
If I could pick any one person?
Yeah, anybody out in the universe to play Diana.
Oh my goodness. I honestly, I haven't thought about it. So I don't know. I don't even know like the people these days. So yeah, I'm pretty out of it.
And, you know, I think Matthew McConaughey should play Tyler, but that's only because I'm a big fan of Green Lights on Audible. But at any rate, one thing Tyler does is he practices these protocols, but there's only one protocol I can't get on board with, and that is his lack of coffee. So that takes us right into... our Area 51 coffee company hot takes. Check them out. Get your own Area 51 coffee. Diana, one of our favorites, Ross Cothart, Australian journalist. He recently talked about there's a giant UFO somewhere. It's super important to the United States. It's super important to the UK. It's super important to Australia. Could this giant, and by the way, it's so huge, they couldn't move it, so they built something on top of it. They built a building on top of it. Could this giant UFO be under the Vatican? Or did you discover that?
Did you discover a giant UFO under the Vatican?
No, I did not. I did not discover a giant UFO under the Vatican. I don't know if a giant UFO exists. I know that Ross has sources, and I know Ross. He's super nice and very excellent journalist. No, I don't. I don't actually... I don't know if there's a big UFO, frankly. And I don't know if there are alien bodies. None of that.
So you're saying it's possible. So it is possible.
I'm saying I neither believe nor disbelieve. And I think that's probably the best thing to do.
Well, another hot take here for you, Diana. This is the Area 51 Coffee Company hot takes. Is that, you know, I've noticed progression with your work. We went from American Cosmic to Encounters. I sort of feel like the next natural progression is what is happening with abductions, because I do feel like some of your work plays into the notion of the potential for human abductions by something else, such as donations. You know, you mentioned in American Cosmic that some people believe that Roswell or other UFO crash retrieval sites were actually donations to us, and so this opens the door to, did our government actually reach some sort of agreement or military in exchange for donations or technology for something else to be given, you know, or allowed to for them to do? What is your hot take on alien abductions?
Right. So alien abductions, so if we're going to look at this as not necessarily alien abductions, so let's take aliens out of the, but just abductions, like, you know, encounters between NHI and humans. This has been happening for a very long period of time. And we can see that in Jacques Vallée's Passport to Magonia, and even in my purgatory research, right, where I was looking at reports of this type of thing in the Catholic record. So, yeah, so it's, you do see that. I don't, the mythology of the United States making a deal I mean, I can't speak to that. I don't have any evidence for that.
Right.
To deal with the devil.
Yeah. Let's make this deal. And, you know, I don't know. I think that for people, this is what I found when I was doing the UFO research for American Cosmic. I found that every single thing out there that had to do with, you know, giving us information about the UFO, not everything, but almost everything, especially the most popular things, they were either fake or they were misinformation. Okay. So I think that everybody has to be careful here that, you know, if there is today, the ways in which this information is conveyed, it's very sophisticated. So it's going to be taking something that you would think is the craziest thing, okay, and then giving evidence for it somehow through credible people or things like that. One thing that Tyler told me is that there's some truth, but it's embedded in so much confusion and so much, basically lies and things like that. So I think that we just, you know, the way to go through this quagmire of information is to just hold out your belief, you know, don't tend towards something. Just get as much information as you possibly can.
Right. And my last Area 51 Coffee Company hot take for you, Diana, it involves religion, ontological shock, technology, the military, secrets, everything. What's your hot take on disclosure? Should the government and military reveal everything they know?
Okay, so should the government reveal everything they know? Well, it depends on what the information is. And I can't actually give any kind of expert opinion on that because, as we know, there are these classified programs. And if you look at the Air Force and its history of the space program, it says, you know, it's very transparent. And it says, the historians for the Air Force say, there are things that we can't discuss because they're still classified, and they're for future historians.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I did want to ask you, and I think you're highly qualified to answer this question. Does the potential for UFOs and extraterrestrial life or aliens, does it pose a risk to religion as we know it?
Oh, yeah, I've been asked this question a lot and by a lot of different types of people. And my opinion, and we also have some data to support this, is that within traditional religions, there's already the category for belief in non-human intelligences. So you see that with the treatise on the angels by John Paul II in the 1980s. No, it's not going to, you know, I think religious people who are practitioners of religions are fine with this. Okay. So, and probably the more religious they are, the more okay they're going to be with any kind of disclosure of this.
Great. Thank you. And that was our Area 51 Coffee Company hot takes. Thank you so much, Diana. Make sure to check out her books. You can pick them up in the links in our description for Encounters and American Cosmic.
All right. I think we have just a couple of listener questions that we'll pull in before we send you on your way here. So we had some people submit questions for you, knowing that you were coming on our show. First one comes from Courtney Marchesani at Inspired Creative on X. At Archives of the Impossible, you mentioned decolonization of UFO culture. What steps have you seen taken on this important issue?
Okay, so the decolonization of UFO culture, I believe that this is basically listening to communities that believe that they've been in contact for, you know, pre-1940s. And I've seen this is a shift in, you know, the ufology that we know from the 1940s has been really based in military conversations. And so I've seen that just recently people are looking at, you know, the conversations that people in indigenous cultures bring to understanding the topic, and also, you know, people who are just everyday people who've had experiences as well. So these conversations are opened up. Encounters actually takes this and deals with this also.
Yeah, such good books. Both of them were really great. So again, those who have not yet, please pick up your copies of American Cosmic and Encounters. Our next question comes from Ed Chi, who's handle on X is Chichu98, which I love. From American Cosmic, can you follow up on the black room that Tyler sat near at NASA and is referenced in UFO of God by Chris Bledsoe?
Okay, so I haven't read UFO of God. So, and I do, the only thing I know is what I wrote in American Cosmic, that there was this room that he sat in and he felt that he was somehow being affected by it. And I described as best I could how he thought he was being, you know, that there were maybe, there was something coming from the room and it affected him in some way because he felt like he was different after being exposed to whatever it was. And it was concrete. So I did the best I could in describing that, but I haven't followed up with Tyler at all about that.
Okay. And it is a very interesting part of that story too. And that was in Florida, right? At a NASA facility. Is that correct?
I'm not sure. Probably.
Okay. All right. And our last question, we love this question. We had it on our last show from Brent. If aliens had a favorite Earth snack, what do you think it would be? Why might they find it out of this world?
Yeah. So what's funny is that there are like, I think there's like the alien pancakes or something like that. And, you know, there are all these strange stories about, you know, aliens and food and stuff. So if they had a snack, what would it be? It would probably be apples. So oh. Apples are really delicious. You can just pluck them off a tree, right? Fine. They're everywhere.
Love that. Yes, apples.
And they're very biblical, by the way.
Well, true.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
Just a biblical connection for sure. Wonderful. Well, Diana, we are so grateful for your time and for having you on our show. We would love to have you back. I feel like there's so much more that we could dive into. And of course, if these two books get turned into a series of sort, we will absolutely have to have a conversation about that. So congratulations on all of your wonderful work. Thank you for everything that you do to enlighten us all. Please do, if you enjoyed the show, subscribe, comment, like, share. Diana, where can our listeners find more on you?
I have a website, dwpasulka.com. You can also find me on Twitter at the handle dwpasulka and Instagram.
Wonderful. Thank you. All right. Well, to all of our listeners, we hope that you will stay happy, stay strange, keep listening to All Things Unexplained. Until next time, everybody. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
Hey, Unexplained Ones. Are you ready for your next adventure? Then look no further than UFO Watchtower in Hooper, Colorado. Experience the wonder of the cosmos with guided tours, skywatching events, and firsthand accounts of their over 300 UFO sightings. Whether you're a seasoned ufologist or just curious, the UFO Watchtower welcomes you to explore the mysteries of the universe. They are currently open on weekends for tours or during the week for camping. Give them a call at 719-378-2296 to book your trip today.
Thanks. Like. Share, follow, comment, subscribe, support. What's your hot take on Travis Taylor?
I've got an exclusive for you guys if you okay. want it about
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Alaska.
We do.
Okay, okay.
More at BigfootUFO.com.
All things unexplained.
So some of that, I think, sir, we'll save for post-session. Mm-hmm.